I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the origins of Mao's Cultural Revolution that begins in 1966 and concludes with his death 10 years later. And I think looking at the whole Cultural Revolution is such a vast topic that really it's difficult to shoehorn that one into 20 minutes. So it's something I'll return to over the next few months and examine it, you know, break it down and examine it in its constituent parts. But looking at where it comes from, I think, is really important because it's such an extraordinary, and I use that term advisedly, such an extraordinary phenomena. Its origins bear some kind of interrogation. One sort of dominant way of understanding the Cultural Revolution is that it was Mao's bid for power following his marginalisation from the Communist Party, from positions of power within the Communist Party during the early 1960s. From 1958 through to 1962, Mao had embarked on the greatest economic debacle, certainly in the history of China, perhaps in world history, given its size and scope of the Great Leap Forward. Mao had enforced collectivization on the Chinese peasantry, with immense brutality and violence. There's a podcast I did a few months ago, in point of fact, on the relationship between Mao and the Chinese peasants. He had imposed centralised quotas for the production, not just of agricultural produce, but also of commodities such as iron and steel. And the result had been an absolute disaster. Don't really want to go too far into looking at the Great Leap Forward at the moment, because again, this is another separate topic of enormous magnitude. But as I've mentioned before, Frank Dakota's book on Mao's Great Famine is an excellent work on this subject and well worth reading. The point, obviously, I'm coming to next is that the Great Leap Forward, it results in this catastrophic famine. Conservative, very low estimates for the numbers who died in the famine of the late 50s and early 60s are something like 18 million. Mid to upper range estimates would be 45 million. Some academics, and this is the scholarship is mentioned in Dakota's book, some academics have put it at anything up to 70 million, and some higher still. Though the thing is with famines that you get this vast range of variables. I think the majority of opinions seems to fall between the 35 to 45 million range, thus making it, you know, I think perhaps the most catastrophic mass killing event of the 20th century. Readers, write in if you know of a bigger one. I'm racking my brains at the moment, but I think that's probably the greatest human catastrophe of the 20th century. And it's up against some stiff composition, as we know. So, male between 62 and 64 is sidelined within the party. There is far more permissible criticism of Mao Zedong's thought at this point than had previously been possible. And it takes something like the famine and the disaster of the Great Leap Forward, where between 58 and 62 are the only years in Chinese history in the 20th century where the economy actually goes into full retreat, actually begins to rapidly shrink. These kind of catastrophes lead really to Mao's position coming under some serious scrutiny. Mao himself, there's another way of looking at the Cultural Revolution. Now, obviously, Mao, from 1966 onwards, seeks to use the Cultural Revolution to undo this kind of reversal in his political fortunes. But Mao also had another motivation, and a lot of it's to do with the Sino-Soviet split, of which I have spoken recently. If you go back a few podcasts, there's one I've done on East Germany's position within the Sino-Soviet split. Mao had worried for a long time that the death of Stalin and the subsequent what he viewed as revisionism by Khrushchev was essentially Soviet communism going soft, that what you would have next in the Soviet Union is a gradual resumption of capitalism and then an undoing of communism the world over. And Mao was obviously interested in his own position, and he thought, well, if we have revisionism there, we'll get it here. And indeed, it's possible for me to make the case that it has begun here already. Part of Mao's rhetoric at the start of the Cultural Revolution that makes the Cultural Revolution distinct from the other periods of mass terror in communist China is that he says, we knew there were counter-revolutionaries. When we seized power, we knew there were the bourgeoisie that needed dealing with. But what we didn't know was that they were in the party. And now it has come to light that the Communist Party of China itself has got these counter-revolutionary elements in it. And so what we need is a renewal, a new level of ideological purity, renewed struggle to constantly be cleansing these dangerous elements out. There's a story, perhaps apocryphal, but one I heard anyway, so I'll tell you now, of Khrushchev's visit to China, which ended rather acrimoniously. And as he visits China during the famine, and Mao and Khrushchev are driving down a road in part of provincial China, rural China, and there are people at the roadside selling their wares, selling whatever possessions they have for a small bowl of rice in order to eat again that day and not die. And Mao points to the peasants and says to Khrushchev, "You see, here's the problem. This is capitalism spontaneously self-emerging, you know, spontaneously self-forming. Wherever you go, you've got to stamp it out." And his view was that if people are selling their belongings, they are trying to profit and they are capitalists, and, you know, that capitalism itself is kind of like weeds that spring from the ground, and only after many, many years of applying the right ideological weed killer can you ensure that it's gone. Again, this could be an apocryphal story, so don't quote me on it. But the point being that from the Maoist worldview, a revolution is meant to be perpetual struggle, that you can't have a period of consolidation, a period of relaxation, a period where things go back to normal until capitalism is defeated worldwide. And the fact that the USSR was engaging in a relaxation of tensions from the mid-60s onwards with the USA following the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that even in the late 1950s, people like presidents such as Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had been meeting with Khrushchev, and there had been some attempt at engagement. This, too, in Mao's view, was the worst kind of revisionism. So the Cultural Revolution can be explained as well as an attempt by Mao to prevent any kind of what he called revisionist or rightist thinking. And an attempt by Mao to once again position China as the real leader of the communist world, and Mao's view of how to take the fight to capitalism was to use Third World Revolution really to do it, that the workers were no longer the vanguard of revolution, but the peasants of the global south, Africa, Asia and South America, that this is the place that really revolution would occur. Mao calls a July 1966 extraordinary meeting of the Chinese Communist Politburo in Beijing a very fateful meeting, in which he denounces certain party members who he believes are threats to him, who he believes don't have the kind of the right kind of revolutionary credentials to support him, and who he believes have kind of aspects of counter-revolutionary thinking in their characters. And it's here that he says that the party itself must be kind of reformed, must be criticised, must self-criticise. But before this, he had already been at work. He had used newspaper articles. He'd gone quiet for quite some time, and then he begins to be published again in various revolutionary newspapers and journals, and begins to criticise his opponents, particularly within Beijing, within the local party in Beijing. And he uses his own personal contacts, who are still loyal to him, even though he is now a marginalised figure.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Another figures like Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping and Zhou Enlai are far more prominent. These are really Mao's kind of lieutenants during the first period from 1949 to about 58, they are far more prominent. So he's working in the background before he kind of publicly kind of re-emerges as a significant figure. And it's at this July meeting that one of the more significant trends of the Cultural Revolution begins. in that Mao gives the nod to university academics and other kind of intellectual figures to be denounced and attacked. The kind of the mass violence of the Cultural Revolution is yet really to begin at this point, but it sets a kind of an ominous precedent for the future. Mao had already, during the 100 Flowers campaign, of which I'm sure I've done something in the past, check out the podcast probably in the last 6 months or so, I'm pretty sure there's something out there. During the 100 Flowers campaign, he'd already encouraged the a flowering of academic dissent, only to crush it fairly swiftly afterwards. Some argue that during the 100 Flowers campaign, this was just naked cynicism to draw his enemies out, but I genuinely think it was something sincere in what Mao was doing, and had second thoughts about it fairly shortly afterwards. The Communist Party wasn't going to simply roll over and let Mao reassert his ideology. There were a radical and more pragmatic strands of thought within the Communist Party, and in July 1966, Mao wasn't fully in control again. There seemed to be plenty of party members who had long and bitter memories of the Great Leap Forward and of the famine, who didn't want further upheaval, and so Mao decides that he's going to sidestep the party now. The party to him are actually this kind of encumbrance to his power. They're not the base of his power anymore. He sees his power as actually being with, you know, for want of a better word, the people. And particularly with grassroots activists, the Red Guards, who are made up of, you know, radical party activists and students and workers. And he believed that the Red Guards could be used actually to attack the party itself. Maoists quickly take over the party apparatus. And so you could say that the Communist Party ceases to be a Communist Party in 1966 and actually becomes a Maoist party, which, you know, there are, you might say these are roughly the same thing, but there is a kind of significant difference, really, between the conventional and slightly more Soviet communism that was being practiced, Soviet communism, you might say, with Chinese characteristics, and the kind of grassroots Maoism that was emerging in the 1960s. So something like about 15 million Red Guards across China, and Mao takes the decision really to kind of leave them off the leash. The newly controlled Communist Party in August 1966 gives Mao the votes, really, to endorse the programme of the Cultural Revolution. There is a 16-point programme that is announced. This means that the 15 million or so Red Guards across China are made the official body to enforce the Cultural Revolution. The peasants, workers and soldiers and the rank and file of China are encouraged really to turn on figures of authority, not just within the party but within society itself. So academics, engineers, specialists, managers, doctors, teachers, anyone that really has any authority at all suddenly comes under attack from local village committees, from revolutionary groups of workers. And this is kind of what Mao is prepared to do, really, to shore up his power. He views, he's reached perhaps a point of suspicion and paranoia akin to Stalin, where he looks at all institutions within Chinese society and sees these as potential threats. Limits to what the Red Guards were meant to and not meant to do, Mao says, really, he's not particularly interested in those limits. And that there, ideally, he wants to leave it to the judgment of the people. And this is, on the face of things, some kind of piece of revolutionary honesty, perhaps, but in reality, it leads to a total radicalization of the Cultural Revolution. There are no parameters, nowhere that in theory the Red Guards and the revolutionary committees can't go. Part of the Cultural Revolution, I think perhaps more people know, is the what's referred to as the destruction of the Four Olds. So the Four Olds is the old customs, the old culture, the old habits and old ideas of China. So this was kind of not so much an attack on the Communist Party, but an attack on anything that predated 1949. Which obviously that the Mao had tried to attack in the previous 5 years, previous decades up until between 1949 and 1966 anyway. But this was a kind of a reinvigoration of this kind of iconoclasm, this sort of tabula rasa approach to China, to wipe out anything from the past at all. There was an element in Russia where a similar kind of culture, particularly during the Civil War and NEP period, where there was this idea that the October Revolution had been, you know, an end of history and a beginning of the kind of the only really authentic and valid period in human history anyway. And therefore it was entirely right to tear down churches and smash icons and that kind of thing. Libraries across China and university departments have burned down. Generations of Confucian and Buddhist writing and really the cultural history of China is chucked on the bonfire. Temples and shrines, Buddhist temples, Confucian temples, shrines, and churches, because there's quite a widespread embracing of Christianity in China, these are all smashed and wrecked. And there is a widespread culture of arresting anyone considered to have counter-revolutionary thought, people who have been in positions of power, people who, well, really anyone that can potentially come under suspicion, but particularly figures of authority, university professors, teachers, that sort of thing, are attacked. Many publicly humiliated. There's widespread torture and mass killing, and long self-criticism sessions where you know, the individual is forced with a placard around their neck to sit in the town square and confess their sins for 3 or 4 days in a row, at which point they're probably quite happy to be shipped off to a labour camp. The Red Guards began to believe, individual groups of Red Guards began to believe that they had a monopoly on revolutionary purity, and that their fellow Red Guards, who perhaps sometimes would be in the same town as them, were right deviationists and needed to be denounced and attacked. So the Red Guards began to fight amongst one another. And up until 1968, the Red Guards had been given control of the army. And it's in 1968 that the army is wrested back from the Red Guards, that really there's some possibility of some kind of end to the Cultural Revolution in sight. But obviously, this doesn't occur for further 8 years. I mean, between 73 and 76, it's petering out. But really, there is a full stop on it following the death of Mao in 1976. Right, so there's probably a whole bunch of other stuff that I haven't mentioned here, things like, you know, Jiang Qing, Madame Mao and the Gang of Four and all that kind of thing. And like I said, I probably don't want to go down that route just yet. There's time for that later on. But looking at the origins, I think, of the Cultural Revolution are really important. And it's important not to go down this simplified route. I suppose I've done a bit of it today, but you know, we've only got 25 minutes of coming up with origins and saying, right, well, it originated from this thing. mass phenomena the Cultural Revolution, the Holocaust, you name it. These things have many roots, many origins. And so if you're writing essays or writing some kind of piece of academic work, you need to just bear that in mind. Just keep that kind of looseness of your sort of frame of reference there. And yeah, that's what I do anyway. Okay, so we've got some interesting stuff coming out. The latest Explaining History title, International Relations from 1870 to 1914, is available. You can check that out on the website. I'll be posting it up today. And it's a new student guide. There are new student guides on Britain 1851 to 1914 due in the next couple of months, and Britain at the Paris, well, not Britain, but the Allied Powers at the Paris Peace Conference. So we're really focusing on making sure that students get everything they need at the moment, within reason, you know, and really bringing out those great student guides so that you guys, as the new term approaches, have everything you need to make a real success of that. Anyway, thanks very much. I'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.